Hello and welcome to Wine Blast. I'm Susie, he's Peter, and in this episode we're diving headlong into the snake pit of confusion, ambiguity and downright mystery that is the notion of minerality in wine.
Yeah, I've got my snake charming hat on. I knew it would come in handy one day. And it's very fetching. This follows on very loosely from our recent episode where we challenged some myths about how geology or soil influences wine. Spoiler alert, probably way less than people like to think. And we touched on the issue of minerals and minerality in that one.
Yeah, we've also alluded to the concept of minerality a few times in the pod. It was relevant in our episodes on Santorini wine, also New Zealand, Chardonnay, and some others too. So we thought it was high time we took this thorny topic on to try to make some sense of it all.
Yeah, we also had a listener question in from Anton, who's originally from Ukraine. And Anton said, I'm a big fan of your podcast. I'd be interested to hear your opinion about minerality in wine. Some experts say that mineral aromas are created during fermentation. Some winemakers say this aroma comes from the soil. To top it all, consumers don't understand what minerality is. If you ask five different people about minerality, you get five different answers. Can you help?
We will certainly try to, Anton. And we also know exactly the right people to draft in to help. For example, sensory scientists and researcher Dr. Heber Rodriguez.
I think that minerality is a word that people needed because we saw consumers saying that they became interested in wine through minerality, you know, trying to discover what minerality was. This word didn't exist before. So, you know, something that creates like a fever amongst wine descriptors.
Also writer Meg Maker.
I think it is useful. I think it's evocative, it's subjective, so it's many things to many people, and therefore it's arguable. And wine people love a good argument.
I think the two of us can firmly vouch for the fact that wine people love a good argument, can't we?
I think we can.
It's the only thing we can agree on, actually. Though we'd probably call it an enthusiastic discussion or something like that, wouldn't we?
I think so. Okay. A heated debate.
There we go. It's a fascinating taste of there, anyway, of what's to come. We've also got a couple of wines open here that we'll be using to put theory into practice. I love that excuse. There we go.
We use it quite a lot, don't we?
Two white wines, one Chablis, and an Assyrtiko from Santorini.
Yeah, and the idea with the wines is to put our own language under the microscope a bit, which should be fun.
Well, also to have a drink, but...
No, but that's anyway, further down the line.
Yeah.
In the meantime, wasn't there another comment you wanted to feature by way of preface?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, got it here. Matt Ridgway wrote in from Chile in response to our episode about soils and geology. He's a winemaker, but describes himself as an outsider and very much self-taught. And he wrote, over the years, I've been amazed at the amount of superstition, witchcraft, and myths that are taken as fact by wine people who have come through the system. One of the big ones for me is hearing winemakers talk about minerality as if the wine tastes of rocks and minerals. This has always sounded like absolute bollocks to me. How can a plant take in insoluble rock and send that alleged flavour to the grapes? It makes no sense whatsoever. And I've essentially been accused of heresy for suggesting it makes no sense.
So there's a bit of profanity in the mix already. Excellent. Despite the fact we're dealing with pretty highbrow notions of perception and minerality.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how you manage it. though, I let's face it, I think where Matt's coming from is a fair enough place to start.
Absolutely.
Because this is something that gets people hot under the collar, and perhaps understandably so. It can be confusing. It can sound pretentious or elitist or deliberately opaque.
Totally. So, you know, I think we should start with a basic recap on the concept of minerality. We can then hear from our expert guests, and then we can maybe see if we can make a final call, a judgment, if you like, on this issue. Is this a word the wine world should get rid of? Or is it actually worth retaining? And if so, why and how? How does that sound for a plan?
Answers on a postcard. No, it sounds great. It's great. So where to start? Perhaps by saying that the term mineral or minerality is a relatively recent invention when it comes to wine. Researchers agree it only started to crop up in earnest from the 1980s onwards. In fact, Heber Rodriguez has pointed out there were no scientific papers on this subject before 2012, but it's become very fashionable very quickly.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we've taken a healthy interest in the language of wine since the start of our careers, you know, as linguists, as writers, and as masters of wine being examined on the subject. You know, we've also been lucky enough to explore this topic and concepts like minerality with legends in the field. You know, people like Dr. Wendy Parr, who's considered the godmother of this field of sensory research, and who we were privileged to have on the podcast talking about New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc back in season two. You know, check that one out. She does touch on how minerality has become a thing there too.
I think so. With that in mind, let's get down to basics. Mineral or minerality are terms used to describe wine, particularly, but not exclusively, white wines made in a fresh, crisp style. So we're thinking Chablis, Sancerre, Santorini Assyrtiko, Etna Bianco. It can refer to a smell, a taste, or a texture. Interestingly, the word minerality doesn't appear in the Collins Dictionary, but the adjective mineral does and is defined as of, relating to, containing, or resembling minerals. And this is perhaps where the confusion starts.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, as we heard in our episode on geology and soil, there is no direct connection between the geologic minerals in the soil and the flavour of a wine. These geologic minerals can't be accessed by the roots and have no flavour anyway. Nutrient minerals are different, but often come from the humus or compost or fertiliser rather than the soil. To quote one research paper, minerality cannot be the taste of minerals, geological or nutrient, in any direct, literal way. Anyway, here's what Professor Alex Maltman had to say about minerality in wine when we talked to him.
What the term is and what it means, I don't know. People love it. It's around as much as ever. It's just, as I see it, a label, a convenient name, a lovable name for a taste perception, which is different for different people. Different people get it in different wines. It may be different things. What it is, well, who knows? There are plenty of suggestions, as you know, about reductive winemaking and sulfur and so on, acidity and stuff. But nobody knows what it is. But people love the term, and so they use the term all the time. You see it all the time. Nothing wrong with it. But it's not particularly helpful if we don't really know what it is. But all I can say with certainty is it is not the taste of minerals from the soil and probably has very little to do with the soil.
We're going to explore some of these themes, but this is a good perspective to start with. So when we think about minerality, we should paradoxically try to put the idea of actual minerals or rocks or geology out of our minds. You know, the vines are not chewing these rocks up and pumping them out as the equivalent of rock smoothies.
That would be a new spin on the paleo diet, wouldn't it? Lithio diet, there you go. Anyway, the most important thing to recognise from the outset about minerality is we're not dealing in literal truth. We're in the realms of metaphor, as many wine tasting descriptors are. Not all, because some things like, you know, acidity and residual sugar are quantifiable, but many wine tasting terms, particularly smells or flavours, are analogies or metaphors. And these are necessarily personal. Everyone lives in their own taste world. Everyone has their own likes and dislikes. Everyone has their own frame of reference and way of expressing things.
And when we start to appreciate this, it helps explain why Alex Maltman's right in that there is a lack of agreement on what minerality actually means in terms of what people are tasting or implying when they say it. Just as there's little consensus as yet on what might be the causes of minerality, though some light is being shed on both these areas, as we'll hear in due course.
Yeah. But all of this is quite abstract, isn't it? I think it would be good to drill down a bit into the concept of minerality and give some examples of more specific tasting terms that might come under this broad heading of minerality.
Okay, so tasting terms that might come under the broad umbrella of minerality might be things like flinty, stone or wet pebble, chalky, oyster or seashell or shellfish, iodine, salty or saline.
Yeah, and struck match is a slightly different category, but I'd stick it in there. Maybe things like graphite, even earthy. Smoky is one that's often mentioned?
All of the above, I would say, yeah. And we have some of these characters right here in our glasses, which we'll be coming on to in a bit. In the meantime, I think we should bring in our first interviewee.
Absolutely, as I take a big swig. So our first guest is Dr. Heber Rodriguez, a sensory scientist and researcher specialising in the psychology of perception, who's worked with Dr. Wendy Parr, among others. He's written or co-authored a number of scientific papers on minerality. He's originally from Brazil, but now working at the English Vine in the UK, and is a self-confessed lover of mineral wine.
And he got into the subject in relation to Chablis, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, absolutely. So he's done some fascinating research in Chablis, trying to understand what minerality means to people, in his words, using sophisticated psychological theories to try to see if there is a scientific foundation behind these cerebral representations. Whew. Which sounds very impressive, doesn't it? Anyway, I started by asking him if his research has shown any consensus when it comes to what minerality is in wine.
After 10 years, then my thesis started, I can say nowadays that no, there is no consensus. So basically, we had different mental representations of minerality. A global consensus among Chablis wine producers is that their wine was mineral. So the terroir of Chablis was mineral, but this doesn't mean that every producer, every winemaker in the world had the same idea of minerality, where the minerality comes from. Yes, so basically, there is no consensus. And when we start making the tastings, the trial, the sensory trials, and you ask them to describe or to rate minerality, they went everyone in different directions. So basically, there is a concept, a global concept of minerality linked to terroir. But when it comes to sensory descriptors, this go very differently, you know. So for us, it was quite exciting because we had material to work on. Yeah.
So Chablis winemakers think their wines are mineral, but they don't agree on what that minerality is. That seems to suggest that there is an element of, without being too cynical, of marketing, of this is Chablis, this is our terroir, our wines are mineral, whatever that means, and therefore that is something we want to promote as an intrinsic quality of our wines. Would you agree, I know this is going a bit further, but would you agree with that, generally speaking, that it's not just a sensorial description, it's actually something which is bigger than that, different?
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, Peter, it's very interesting what you say, because in Chablis at that time, 10 years ago, and we start to work with minerality, there were no scientific publications made around this sensory term. So everyone has their own opinion, their own idea. So people start to put in the labels, and you know that the words that the consumers read in the labels actually influence the way that they buy and they perceive the wine. And another thing that I remember to see in these times in Chablis is that people start to use, when consumers were there, or tourists, wine tourists were there visiting, they start to show like minerals from the soils and put this in the labels as well. So there were a big market construction around the word minerality and what was their own definition based on terroir.
So it's the power of suggestion almost, and this is sort of crossed over via osmosis into maybe media and wine drinkers, wine consumers perhaps. But does that mean that the term minerality is without value? I mean, presumably not.
No, we know, yes, this question is quite interesting to answer, because we know what minerality isn't. Actually, you know.
Well, then let's go into what isn't minerality?
Yes. Yeah, so minerality, the research that we've made is that minerality, a mineral wine can't be a floral wine, for example. You know, floral, when we analyze the data that we collected in Chablis or other colleagues around the world, we see that the floral sensory descriptors are always opposite to mineral sensory descriptors. So when people perceive one type of descriptors, this family floral, in aromas, for example, they will not perceive mineral, you know, or minerality-related sensory descriptors like reduced compounds and shellfish, chalky, and every type of these types of... So basically, it's not only floral, but all these... tropical fruits and white fruits and oaky aspects of the wine. So these types of descriptors, these families of descriptors, they are in opposite to minerality. So when a consumer perceives one, they will not probably not perceive the other.
So to simplify it, when you've got really bold characters in wine, that's often the opposite of, you know, like tropical fruit, like flowers, like oak. That's the opposite of mineral. Could you then infer that minerality could almost be analogous with kind of an absence of strong character, an absence of flavor?
Absolutely. And if you go to the history of, let's say, Chardonnay and basically Chardonnay from Chablis, for example, in these wines that are described as very mineral, before people start to use the word mineral in the 80s, they used to use the word austere to these wines. Yeah. Mm. So this is very interesting, because if you observe attentively what the word austere means, this means that it is not an open wine. And when we say open in sense, we say open in terms of aromatic character. So for example, these wines that are strongly or bold, has this bold character, they probably were not mineral as well. So this is just a link between history and where we are today in terms of what minerality is, or, you know, what we're still using to find about minerality.
Has your research shown differences between wine professionals and normal everyday wine drinkers when it comes to perceiving and rating minerality?
Mm-hmm. We did indeed one research with consumers, average consumers, and we can see, for example, that consumers, they follow what the winemaker says, so what they've been communicated. So basically, we just published a paper about the elegance in wines, and we've seen that there is a very good communication chain in between winemakers, wine marketers, and wine consumers. So what show us that basically what you said before about sensory marketing, this can influence, and this influence for true, for real. So we know also that when, for previous research, that when we increase the level of knowledge of a taster, for example, he will start to develop more vocabulary, and this can influence. Nevertheless, if you think that minerality is a multimodal, because this is proven that minerality is a multimodal sensory descriptor, what means that you can perceive it in mouth, you can perceive it in nose, and we can probably perceive it in, was never tasted before, but we can probably perceive it by our eyes as well, through our view, because we normally associate more gold color, pale wines to be more oxidized. And for an effect of anticipation, we can say probably this will not be mineral because it's oxidizing, and oxidized aromas, they are opposite as well to, or flavors opposite as well to mineral ones. So as minerality, as I said, is a multimodal sensory descriptor. And also in this multimodality is also a multidimensional one. That means that we have different dimensions on that. So we can have dimensions of taste, of flavors, of aromas, and basically different, can be empyromatic, can be chalky, can be freshness, can be acidity. So we have different, actually is like a carnival of an apotheosis of different types of descriptors that are linked to minerality. So for the consumer, it's difficult to acquire all these dimensions. However, if there is a sensory marketing there, you know, saying the right terms, maybe the consumer will acquire easily, you know, this vocabulary as well.
That's absolutely intriguing. A carnival of multimodality. That probably doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but I'm just going to leave it there because it's quite a fun phrase. But you haven't, just to sort of finish off on this, you haven't found evidence, for example, saying that wine professionals love it, this minerality thing, because it's arcane and it's weird and it's something that's not obvious, and that consumers don't actually like it because it's weird.
Yeah. So basically what the literature says to us, shows to us, is that wine professionals or wine experts like critics and other categories of experts, people that study wine, basically, they quite like this reductive type of aromas or flavors. And sometimes it's difficult for the consumer to appreciate in the same way that the professional do. So basically, we can say yes, that sometimes if the minerality is too strong, the intensity of minerality, and this is something current in the discourse of winemakers, that they need sometimes to try to make more subtle the minerality, to let more palatable to the consumer, you know. So we have these ranges of differences that are quite interesting in minerality as well.
That's really interesting. I did, in your Chablis paper, you do talk about people limiting minerality almost intentionally, because they say actually that eventually the wine has to be drinkable. So there is such a thing as potentially as too much minerality.
Absolutely, absolutely. A very interesting phrase that I remember is that, and this opens my PhD thesis, is a winemaker from Chablis that said that the minerality is the memory of the sea. And this is quite poetic and quite beautiful when we think about an interpretation that one can have from this phrase. And basically, after several interviews, we saw that people, they think, they really think that the minerality comes from the terroir. They cannot make minerality, but they can adapt minerality, maintain or increase or even decrease by their viticultural and winemaking practices, for example.
It's very romantic anyway. But so let's go there then. I know maybe pushing into areas you're slightly less comfortable with, but is there any evidence that you found in your research that minerality is an expression of the scene, of the site, of the soil, for example?
Yeah, so what I think that the... thinking about all these studies, I think what the winemakers made reference about the influence of soil is not all the minerals in the soils, but how deep is the soil, the type of soil as well, and the temperature of soil, you know, and the quantity of water in the soil. So this could bring more or less minerality, you know, depending on the type. For example, limestone or clay, there is a great a belief in this area that limestone soils, based soils, they bring much more minerality than clay soils, you know. And when he did the research around these, the tastings and the chemical side as well, we saw that these wines from one bank where the wine, the soil was more limestone, they were really more mineral as well, perceived as mineral. Mm. So there's something there, you know.
So there could be something happening. It's not necessarily the minerals from the soil coming through. It could be the water hole, you know, the way the vine interacts with the water in the soil and various other things that could be having an effect. To switch, I know you're a sensory scientist, not a chemist, but have you found any links? You talk about reductive and reduction earlier. Have you found any links between volatile sulfur compounds and minerality in wine?
Yes, indeed. We do. In this study, where we compared both sides of the Seren River in Chablis, so we had the left side, the left bank side, and the right bank side, we took different Premier Cruz bottles of Chablis, and we did lots of tastings and descriptions and ratings of minerality. And then we sorted these wines into the more minerals and the less mineral, you know. And then we went to the lab and we did several analyses, chemical analysis, volatiles, everything. And we saw that when people, they rated more mineral the wines and described the wines as having more shellfish aromas, there was a component, a methanol tile that was totally directly link it with this perception of minerality, you know. So we say, okay, so this makes this aroma of shellfish, and you compare it with the literature of shellfish, aromatic compounds, and we were there. So basically, this was a strong evidence that we had that the minerality was linked to the descriptor shellfish.
So there does seem to be a link between these volatile sulfur compounds like methanethiol or methanethiol, other things, like BMT, benzene methane diol as well, and polysulfanes. Is that right? There seems to be a link between these things and a perception of minerality. And again, without going too far into winemaking, though, as far as I understand, these compounds are the production of yeasts acting on flavor precursors in the juice. So actually, you can argue here that this minerality is coming from the yeasts in one sense.
Yes, this can be.
Do you think we need to be more specific in our language? And do you think minerality is a catch-all term which refers to different things? Do you think we need to evolve our language when it comes to using a term like minerality?
I think actually that minerality is a word that people needed, you know, to increase as well the interest about wine is in the world, because we saw consumers saying that they became interested in wine through minerality, you know, trying to discover what minerality was. So this is very interesting because this word didn't exist before. You know, there is a French literary person called Marguerite Duras that wrote a book in the end of the 40s, beginning of the 50s, called Les Impudents, where she talked the first time about minerality. So, you know, these white wines, they tasted these slopes of a landscape or something like this. So people start to be curious to know what was minerality. And as I said before, the word austere was used at that time in the 70s and 80s to describe Chablis wines, you know. And then people just replace it for a more funny word, let's say like this, that didn't exist in the book, in the dictionary. So, you know, something that creates like a fever amongst wine descriptors. And I think that we need more sensory descriptors that can make easy the understanding. Of course, not too mineral ones, because minerality is quite a difficult one for the consumer. But I think that we need more diversity in terms of sensory descriptors, you know, not only fruity or oaky, you know, or these ones that we find in the aroma wells and the wine educators they use in their classes, you know.
So the language of wine should actually keep evolving and become more diverse, in your opinion. That's a lovely thought. Eva, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
So he is actually a minerality fan at heart, even though he acknowledges the term's shortcomings and ambiguities and the fact it may well have come from marketing speak originally.
Yeah, but it's fertile territory for a researcher, isn't it? You know, I love the sense of perspective he brings to, like, you know, the Marguerite Duras being a pioneer. You know, I remember studying her at school and I didn't realise she was this would crop back up. But then also minerality sort of replacing austere in wine terminology. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. You know, and minerality is a lot cooler, isn't it, than austere as a word.
I suppose it is, yeah. And there's an implicit connection with the land as well when you say mineral, isn't there? Yeah. You know, it almost sounds healthy, you know, wholesome, like you're standing in a vineyard at one with nature, almost drinking in the landscape.
Yeah, that's a nice idea, isn't it? And that sense of poetry and romanticism he touched on too. Minerality as the memory of the scene, you know. We're going to come back to this, but it's also important to pick up on minerality as a multimodal and multidimensional phenomenon too. You know, even our eyes playing a part. Fascinating. You know? So this sense of an all-encompassing experience, a sort of a feeling almost, even if it's subjective and vague, a carnival of descriptors. Only a Brazilian could get away with saying
that. I think so. But also, actually, interesting the link with volatile sulfur compounds from winemaking and yeasts, and the fact it's often correlated with an absence of strong other characters like florality or oak or tropical fruit. Sounds like we still need more research, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that very note, coming up, we have more fascinating insights and views from writer Meg Maker. By way of quick recap, no one is really clear what minerality in wine means or what causes it. The scientists are on the case, though. It could be linked to vineyard, or it could be influenced by the winemaking, where volatile sulfur compounds seem to play a role, for example. It's more clear what minerality is not, be it the flavour of geologic minerals from rocks, or pronounced fruity, floral, or oaky flavours in wine. But despite its ambiguity and general mystery, it's clearly a term that's popular and isn't going away anytime soon.
So let's bring in Meg Maker at this point. Meg is a US-based writer and wine expert who has worked in many different fields. She describes her background as multidisciplinary. I should say that in this interview, Meg refers to the WSET, which is the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, the main global body for teaching people about wine. She takes an active interest in the language of wine, a liquid she describes as ineffable.
Yeah, so I started there by asking Meg, how can we communicate effectively about something that by its very nature is hard to put into words?
Yeah, wine writers rely heavily on metaphor and analogy for communicating about a wine. And the term minerality in particular, right, which is the topic here, it's really a metaphor to my mind. And I've heard you say that also elsewhere on the podcast, that minerality is metaphorical. Metaphors are terms like muscular or explosive or ethereal or powerful. They're abstractions, and they answer questions about a wine's overall character or personality. Analogies are terms like black cherry or vanilla or cured meat. You know, they answer questions about what a wine tastes like. And like is that word that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting there. Like is an analogous comparison. So wine writers tend to rely on a mix of metaphor and analogy to make claims about their personal experience of a wine. And that's separate from the wine's provenance, who made it, why it matters, how it fits into the pantheon of the world's wines, whether it's new or creative in some way, or whether it's traditional and has strong typicity. But these metaphors and analogies that we use as wine writers try to help convey our personal experience, try to help put words around that ineffable quality of flavor so that others can imagine what we are experiencing.
So minerality for you is fundamentally a metaphor. For metaphors to work, there needs to be an element of communication though, doesn't there? We need to kind of know what we're referring to and talking about. Does it work? Does minerality work in that sense of a shared metaphorical value?
I think to some degree it works because it's arisen as a shorthand, as many of our wine terms have become. In that sense, it can sometimes seem a little lazy because it prevents us from interrogating what exactly we're talking about. Is it an olfactory sensation? Is it a textural sensation? Is it something more like direct chemical detection, like salt, like saline taste? And so I think it is useful. I think it's evocative. Again, it's metaphorical. It's subjective. So it's many things to many people. And therefore, it's arguable. And wine people love a good argument. I think this is why we've fallen in love with this term, because it is something that can be kind of many things to many people. You can make it your own in a sense. But I do think that it's useful to people. However, I encourage writers to try to unpack their sensations and interrogate what exactly they're experiencing with their sensorium, and then put it in fresh words, put it in their own words, and not be afraid to use personal references, because that can lead to storytelling and that can lead to a richer engagement, really, with the other person, with the reader, or with the person that we're speaking with.
So would you encourage the wine world, and I'm including wine lovers in this as well, who I think seem just as keen to use the word minerality or mineral as much as us wine professionals, are you encouraging us to actually just think a bit more about what we're saying? Don't just rely on a relatively facile term, minerality, which seems to be very broad and very subjective, and instead say, you know, drill down a bit more and say, actually, what do we really mean when we're saying this wine is mineral?
Yeah, I think so. I think any shorthand needs to get interrogated periodically. You know, is it suggestive? Because you're drinking a Chablis, are you assuming that this is wine is mineral? Are you simply saying it's mineral because you're tasting 13 Chablis? Or is it a perceived reality for you? Is it a smell or a taste? Is it a texture? And I think more to the point, wine writers are, we hyper-emphasize the olfactory qualities that we're experiencing. This has become a trend in the last 20 or 30 years, popularized by some critics, lavish descriptions, lavish tasting notes, which sometimes are really just more about making sales than they are about really communicating personal experience. But, you know, to focus on texture, character, shape, style, balance, the provenance of the wine, the history and its typicity, things like that. I think that those things can convey more about a wine that add dimension to the wine that isn't strictly olfactory.
Do you think there is a bit of marketing speak creep in the use of the word minerality, which is a relatively recent term? Is there an element, do you think, of winemakers saying, hang on, if we talk about terroir and we talk about minerality, and the two almost seem to be, you know, fundamentally linked. If we talk about these things, it emphasizes the uniqueness of our wine. So we're going to do that. And I think Chablis is a very good example of that.
Yes, I do think so. I think you're right, Peter. When I travel and speak with winemakers, it is a term that comes up very often. You know, the Italians use a term sapidity. They use the English sapidity, sapidite. And that refers to a kind of a saltiness or minerality. It's not a really perfect translation. And, you know, the winemakers do love to think of minerality. It seems romantic. I'm so glad you brought up the word terroir. You know, because when I think about what it makes to make a wine, wine requires four kingdoms and a place. And so the four kingdoms are plants. So obviously grapes, cover crops, any other vineyard plants, fungi, yeast, of course, but soil fungi and the mycorrhizae that are symbiotic, bacteria, lactic acid bacteria at the very least, but others as well that are ambient, animals, soil critters, insects, humans, and human geography and tradition as well. Wine doesn't get made without us, and it doesn't actually get to be wine until we experience it. So it doesn't fulfill its destiny until it's tasted. And then place, which is site, climate, geology. And when we talk about terroir, we tend to overemphasize place. But the other factors, to my mind, are equivalent. It's a collaborative. And so when we overemphasize place, we romanticize it, it becomes nostalgic, we think of place as definitional. I think that's maybe why we love to think about minerals in the soil getting into the wine and affecting our experience of it. We romanticize place, and therefore if we're romanticizing wine, it's this thread that connects them.
You mentioned other regions where you think minerality is important or highlighted particularly by winemakers. Where else would that be outside of Chablis?
Yeah, so wines from certain soils tend to have this word applied to them quite often. You know, limestone soils, Chablis obviously among them, Kimmeridgian, chalk, old sea deposits, you think of the Dolomites, Chablis, et cetera. Curiously, not as much in Champagne, I think because of so much winemaking that goes into Champagne and, you know, the multi-vintage character of most of the juice. Volcanic wines, iron-rich soils in particular, do seem to do something to a wine. You know, Etna, Canary Islands, the Dundee Hills in Oregon, Jory soils there. Again, I'm thinking though that it's microbial activity in the soil and not the minerals themselves, because there's good science that says that the minerals in the soil do not make their way into the wine. But then at the other end of the scale, there are seacoast wines, you know, Santorini. I know you just did an episode on Santorini, Rius Baixus. If there's salt in the air, that can get deposited onto the fruit, and that actually can end up in the fermentation. But then the yeast have to deal with it as well. And yeast is another issue that adds a lot of complexity to this question of minerality.
Can I ask, turning it back on you then, as a wine connoisseur, as a wine lover, and someone very interested in the language of wine, if you find yourself writing or wanting to write a mineral about a wine, how do you then clarify or make your language a bit more specific and less vague?
Yes, I used to use it and I stopped using it. And what I try to do now is reach for whether it's an olfactory sense that I'm getting. Petrichor, I love the word petrichor. It's a term that a lot of people don't know, but I think it is something that a lot of people all over the world can relate to, the smell of, actually, it's volatile substances in the soil that steam off when rain hits the soil. It's that smell. I think we can all imagine it. If we've been in a muddy place or a dirty place when the rain starts. Honestly, though, Peter, I'm trying to de-emphasize the olfactory in my notes. I find that this fruit salad tasting notes, they're useful for personal reference. I'll put them in my own note, but I might not publish them so that I can remember what that wine tastes like for me. But I'm not sure that other people really disambiguate between blackberry, black raspberry, lemon zest, lemon peel, lemon juice, lemon drop, lemon whatever.
So if you are de-emphasizing the olfactory, what are you placing more emphasis on now to communicate about the wine?
Yeah, I started emphasizing texture. I'm also very interested in the wine making. I do think that there's a range of olfactory and trigeminal sensations that can be described using either direct detection. This wine has high alcohol. This wine is a little bit of residual sugar. And then the sort of more personal impact or how I would serve this wine. Why this wine matters from a contextual basis. Like, this was a young woman winemaker. Is this her first vintage? She's just, you know, she's renting a space and she's buying fruit from her friends. And, you know, that story of the wine, I think, is much more interesting and engaging.
Do we need to evolve our language when it comes to terms like minerality? And I say that about wine language in general as well.
I think we do need to evolve our language. I think we need to acknowledge our own reference frame. Where am I coming from when I speak about this wine? What are my personal analogies and reference? If I say this wine smells like my grandmother's closet or it reminds me of my grandmother's linen closet, that's going to mean something to me. It may not mean something to other people. There are problems with the established lexicons that have been well discussed elsewhere, and the Eurocentric references, for example. I don't know that minerality falls into that. The systematic tasting method of the WSET does include a mineral section, and that includes whetstone, slate, flint, petrichor, struck match, those kinds of terms. Also metaphors like smoky, earthy, or petrol. And, you know, I know what minerality is not. It's not fruit, floral, herbal, vegetable, spice, toast, wood. It's not the lactic and oxidative things. It's not savoriness. But I think that all of this encourages us to do a kind of checklist, punch list wine descriptors. You take your WSET lexicon down off the shelf and you say, well, it's this and that and the other thing. And it doesn't inspire the kind of literary creativity that I would like to see more writers pursue. I think we write about wine not just because we know about wine. We write about wine because we like to write. We like to communicate. And so I encourage people just try to be creative. Own your reference frame. Acknowledge where you're coming from. Acknowledge that other people may not have the same reference frame. But then try to use that wine as a way to connect with other people in some small but meaningful way.
So we need to be honest and creative in an attempt to communicate and connect with other people better. Meg, that's an absolutely wonderful point to end on. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, thank you.
So Meg's not anti-minerality either, but she is encouraging us to be more creative, more specific, maybe move away from just focusing too much on the aromas and engage with the broader story and context of the wine as a way to connect with people.
Yeah, and maybe there's a place for minerality in that. You know, at one point in our discussion, she said minerality sounds delicious. And I know what she means. It sort of sounds bizarrely appealing, doesn't it?
It does.
But I agree with her, you know, in that trends in wine have led to tasting notes that are just lists, essentially, of fruits and herbs, you know, aided and abetted by the famous wine aroma wheel, perhaps also fueled by critics pumping out hundreds of tasting notes on very similar wines which need differentiating. And, you know, we are not without blame.
We're not.
But maybe we should be trying to move creatively away from this kind of paradigm.
Agreed. And she also shared a fascinating article, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. It's called How Robert Parker's 90 Plus and Anne Noble's Aroma Wheel Changed the Discourse of Wine Tasting Notes. And it's by Andrew James, who was at the time associate professor at Meiji University in Japan. He writes, "The current trend among magazine tasting note writers is to use hyperbolic notes full of overly precise descriptors. The purpose of wine speak ought to be to facilitate communication. Wine has always been a social beverage best enjoyed in the company of others. Too often in today's tasting notes, simplicity and clarity are sacrificed. Writers seem more interested in passing judgment and affixing a numerical value to a wine than they are in trying to understand it and appreciate its virtues." That's a paper from 2018. Right?
Punchy. Well, why don't we square the circle by bringing things back to us? We've got two wines here.
We love
here.
Doing that.
Let's talk about us. but we'd be tempted to label these wines mineral, wouldn't we?
Yes.
What do we really mean, though? Can we do better than that?
Well, that's just, you know, we've had sips, haven't we already? So we're going to have to work for our lovely idea. I'm going to be frank and say, I think you use the term mineral more than me.
I agree.
Yeah, okay,
I'm going to agree.
I just don't generally like it, I think, you know, because it's ambiguity. But, you know, here with this Santorini, which is the delicious and Hydros Afura Assyrtiko 2021, it's really hard to describe this wine without using the term minerality. Mm. You know, there's not much in the way of fruit or herbs. There's a tiny bit of oak, but really it's quite reserved aromatically, sort of shy almost. But at the same time, you sense intensity here. You know, it's not much character, but
there's persistence.
There is intensity. So it draws you in with a sort of faintly smoky, sort of bready, flinty character, for want of a better term.
There you go. You're talking minerality. I'm sorry.
This is really important. I don't think we're trying to deny that this character exists.
No.
These characters exist in wines. What I am trying to do is be a bit more specific and clear, you know, hopefully via things that people can relate to. But, you know, really, if I were describing this wine, I would try to focus on the flavour profile. You know, it's all about this gloriously juicy, vibrant, fresh acidity, isn't it? It's delicious. You know, an elegant texture, a sort of serious complexity, and then a salty finish. But you know, right there, salty, that's an interesting aspect that falls under the minerality umbrella, isn't it? Because Santorini is a rare example of a vineyard where salt does get into the wine off the sea air on the grapes, you know, as we heard in our Santorini episode, and that is a literal mineral. Yeah.
And you say a rare example of that happening.
It's a rare example.
But it's fair to say this is a wine that displays what tends to be described as minerality in several different ways. You know, some of them relate to the vineyard, some possibly to the winemaking and volatile sulfur compounds. But even you, as a minerality skeptic, you would agree there are mineral characters.
Absolutely. But like I say, you know, I just try not to use that term because it's a bit lazy and also a bit of a cliche when it comes to Santorini Assyrtiko, though. You know, and if I were really trying to explain this wine, I'd also talk about the context and the story. You know, this volcanic island in the middle of the Aegean Sea with this ancient vineyard made of painfully low-yielding basket vines, carefully aged in relatively neutral oak, in contact with the yeast lees, you know, made by one of the island's newer producers, aiming for really precise, high-quality wines, you know, etc. And that this is a wine to put with seafood or something like spicy chicken or an invigorating aperitif. You know, it works well like that, rather than focusing just on the minerality. But rant over. What about your Chablis?
I'm just sitting here with my Chablis.
We're very happy.
I'm cuddling my Chablis.
Your Chablis there.
This is a funny old bottle. It's actually a 2010 Premier Cru made by the UGC Co-op. A fairly modest wine, which we thought we'd left far too long to drink and would have died by now. But while it does taste evolved, you've got some honey and truffle and slightly mushroomy characters here, it still has that stony minerality on the finish that is very Chablis and very appealing.
Yeah, sorry, I think it's the UVC that's made that. Sorry, yeah, but I'm going to stop you there. What do you mean by stony minerality?
Well, okay, there's a texture and sort of subtle flavour that you might imagine getting if you were licking a smooth pebble.
Yeah,
in a kind of flintiness too. And of course, you would expect this character to be in there when the wine's young, but I do think most people would understand what I mean, and it's still there when the wine's older.
Well, how many of us lick a pebble in the course of the day.
But it's the thought, you know, that thing where it slightly dries your tongue, but in not a terrible way.
It's a textural
sensation.
There's
a sort of a freshness and a chalkiness and a flintiness all into
one. So it's
almost
like a equivalent of tannin in whites, but it's not that actual.
Yeah,
it's just a sort of kind of replica of that kind of sensation.
And I think it's just enough to say that.
All right. Well, in talking about tannins, in reds, I've noticed you often talk about chalky tannins. What do you mean by that?
Well, again, I'd say it's a textural quality. Mm. It means fine-grained, elegantly drying. I guess it's a visual metaphor almost, you know, fine chalk dust to convey that tactile sense of very fine tannins. It is a shorthand.
Yeah, interesting. And although we don't use it like this, some people refer to that struck match character of oaky white wines, particularly as mineral, don't they? And, you know, which we discuss in our New Zealand Chardonnay episode, and which some people term flinty or funky.
I think you termed it snap, crackle and pop, didn't you, for some bizarre reason.
And Rice Krispies just sprang to mind.
of course, they did.
It's a multimodal expression, and I'm cool with that.
Anyway, I mean, Michael Brajkovic of Cumi River was quite clear how that formed, which is by using elemental sulphur in the vineyard shortly before harvest, which then comes through into the ferments via turbid juices and gives that struck match character post-fermentation. Mm. Mm. So again, whether we refer to that as funkiness or flint or positive sulphide character or whatever, we could be more specific than calling it mineral, because it is a specific winemaking character.
Exactly. And incidentally, I did talk to Heber about volatile sulphur compounds, particularly, he calls it methanethyl. I want to call it methane thiol, which he found was correlated with the perception of minerality or seashell character in right bank Chablis. Apparently, you do smell it in cooked shellfish. Mm. So it's a direct sort of transference or analogy. And apparently the thiol, the sulfur compound, related to the flinty note, for example, in Sancerre, is benzene methane thiol or benzene methanethyl or BMT.
I'm glad you're saying that.
And there's also, we also mentioned polysulfanes, which seem to act in a similar way. All of these sort of, you know, volatile sulfur compounds coming from fermentation and yeast action on flavour precursors in the juice. Anyway, you know, more research is clearly needed, but it does seem like these post-fermentation characters produced by yeast acting on flavour precursors in the grape juice do have a material impact on minerality in a wine. You know, we could call them elegant sulfidic characters or gentle funkiness.
Or just minerality. Keeping it simple. But it is probably worth adding here, there are also interesting correlations with high acidity levels or low pH. So in effect, crisper or fresher wines are potentially more likely to be perceived as mineral. Mm-hmm. So ripeness levels and harvest timing seem to be important in this equation too.
So it's not just about the vineyard.
Yeah.
It's not
actually
about the winemaker.
No, and there could be a link with closures. For example, the more hermetic screw caps versus cork. Anyway, have we covered off all our mineral references? I know we can't cover them all, but you sometimes talk about steely acidity, don't you?
That's a fair cop. But for me, that's just a measure of intensity, you know. So if the acidity is really tangy and strong, I'll call it steely. But maybe think about it, that's an unhelpful metaphor. I'm not saying it tastes like steel.
Mm.
Steel doesn't taste. Unlike you, I don't go around licking steel girders. you go around licking pebbles.
You don't know what you're missing.
What about just while the thought occurs? What about earthy or forest floor in reds? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's often a function of age, isn't it? You know, of development with reds, where they veer into mushroom or truffle character, especially with something like a Pinot Noir or Nebbiolo.
Yeah, okay.
So not mineral for me. Though you do get warm earth on some especially warmer climate reds like, I don't know, Roussillon, which is perhaps more a feeling of sun-ripened fruit and baked wild herbs, a feeling of the sun really beating down on the vineyard.
But I'm going to pick you up on that. It's a feeling, isn't it? You know, maybe another shorthand for a combination of factors, like, as you say, ripe fruit, ripe herbs, lowish acidity, ripe tannins, warming alcohol, rather than sort of outright minerality.
Yeah, fair enough. So before you pull me up on anything else, this has been a long old programme, so we need to wrap things up. By way of summary, we're starting to understand what is meant by and what causes minerality, but it's a complex topic which remains contentious and intriguing. Mm. Perhaps we're barking up the wrong tree in trying to attain total clarity here. Maybe we should be celebrating the beautiful, broad brushstroke of minerality, its rich metaphorical power and implicit connections to the land and to the art, as well as the science of winemaking, and the fact it seems to denote quality and complexity in wine.
Maybe. But either way, Anton, I hope we've gone some way to answering your question. Personally, I think it's all about how this term is used, you know, the intent, as it were. You know, if people are trying to use it to make wine fun and engaging and appetizing, maybe with an air of mystery and intrigue, but hopefully not too much, that's okay. That's fine. But if it's being used simply as a marketing tool to say, this wine is from my land and no one else can do this, that's not good. I also don't like it when it's used in a pretentious or elitist way, or if it ends up being ambiguous and unclear. None of that's cool, and it's not good for the wine world in general. Above all, minerality is not really about minerals.
So there we have it. A split judgment from us, but ultimately we're not going to condemn minerality. We should embrace it, but embrace it better. Huge thanks to Dr. Heba Rodriguez and Meg Maker. Thanks also to Anton, Matt Ridgway and Dr. Alex Maltman. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Until next time, cheers.